Hello and welcome to the Monocle Culture Show with me, Robert Bound. We're kicking off 2019 by rounding up a few things that we'll be looking forward to seeing throughout the year ahead. We've enlisted the help of some cultural connoisseurs to tell us what's coming up on the TV, the silver screen and in galleries. And those experts are Peter White, international editor at Deadline Hollywood, Anna Smith, film critic and host of the podcast Girls on Film, Gareth Harris, chief contributing editor to the Art newspaper. Happy New Year, everybody. Nice to have you all in the studio.
Hello.
Hi.
Happy New Year.
Hello, Happy New Year.
Thank you very much. Okay, before we kind of turn over the myths and wisdom of the New Year hangover, let's crash straight into this. Peter White, we're going to kick off with TV. Are you looking forward to 2019? Are your eyes going to be square?
I think our eyes are going to be square every year from now on, aren't they? We seem to watch more television, film and everything else in between than we ever did before.
You're in the right business, is what you're saying.
Yes.
Seems good.
There's quantity and quality, I think, in many ways. But yeah, there's more telly than there's ever been. I think, you know, you look at the number of US scripted shows, we're well over 500, and then there's, you know, hundreds and if not thousands more coming from everywhere else in the world.
Last time we spoke, and our listeners would have heard your voice, and we're at the MIPCOM TV Festival in Cannes in October. How many of those things that you saw there or that you were having meetings about and writing about there kind of filter through to be on the TV?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of the things that you and I would have talked about back in October in Cannes wouldn't be on air until later this year, if not even further. They plan ahead quite a long way ahead. So you've got shows, things I think you and I were talking about, Good Omens, which is the adaptation of the Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett book, which stars Michael Sheen and David Tennant. You know, BBC Studios would have been talking about that in Cannes, and that will be on air on Amazon later this year. So yeah, a lot of those shows, some of the documentary stuff and the non-scripted side of things gets on air a little bit quicker, but drama does tend to take a little bit longer.
Let's start with drama, Euphoria. This is produced by HBO and presumably on that platform itself. Talk us through this one, please.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an interesting project. It's actually an Israeli format. Came out of a production company called Teddy, made for a broadcaster in Israel called Hot 3, which is one of their cable platforms. HBO is essentially remaking it. They are putting a whole bunch of American kids. It's been described as Kids meets Trainspotting, so it's quite dark, if you can imagine.
I kind of like the sound of that.
You remember Kids? Yeah. Do you remember the if it ends up half as screwed up as that, and Trainspotting, I guess. It's a really interesting show. It's essentially an even darker version of Skins with some murder thrown in. It's about these teenagers. There's a murder outside a club, I guess in the States, in the US version, in Israel obviously, in the local version, and then it's all about how these kids essentially react to that. Some go, you know, well off the grid, some sort of go up and do drugs, some, you know, crash and burn in other ways. So it looks at all these different ways of doing it. There's a young actress called Zendaya. She's been in Spider-Man recently. She was in the Hugh Jackman film, The Greatest Showman. She's basically the lead of this. But it's got some really interesting production people behind it. So Drake, the rapper, is exec producing with Future the Prince. So it's got this really interesting background of, you know, how it came about. And the company that's making it is a company called A24, which is better known in the film business for things like Moonlight and Lady Bird.
Oh, yeah. So what's the deal with Drake and Future the Prince sitting in the exec producer roles with something like this? Is this a move from them into TV, or is this, have they sprinkled some magic dust on the script? Or what is this, just a money thing?
You see a lot of this these days with celebrity exec producers, and there's two ways. Some people get really involved, and some people just lend their name so it can get financed and produced. I think in this case with Drake, it seems like it's a little bit of both. He sort of had a bit of an entertainment background when he was younger and wants to sort of move into this world. And you look at, you know, basketball stars like LeBron James is now exec producing drama. So there's all sorts of people that, you know, realize there's a lot of money in telly and you know, they want to be associated with cool projects. I think with him, yeah, as I say, it would have helped get it financed, would have helped get it produced. It certainly would have helped HBO, you know, make that final decision. Whether he lends a little bit of credibility, I guess, to the story is probably more than anything, rather than him making notes on scripts.
HBO back in the day used to be synonymous with being able to play the length of shows. Used to fiddle about with stuff. This was obviously the kind of, you don't have to write every episode like a cliffhanger, because it was the invention of the binge watching thing. And also the content was different, I suppose, because you could do things that weren't public service and you could include all sorts of different stuff. If this is kind of like a kids versus Trainspotting thing, and there's drugs and there's violence and all the rest of it, is this kind of classic HBO territory? They kind of going back to the things they used to do?
I think so, yeah. You remember Oz, you remember Sopranos, you know, Sex and the City, for instance. So, yeah, it's never really gone too far away from that. They've done, you know, I guess Game of Thrones is a little bit different, but, you know, on the whole, they've always had a couple of really dark projects in the works at HBO. Last year, they had Succession, which was the Brian Cox show, which was rather dark as well. They like that world, and they still are, you know, however much we talk about Netflixes and Amazons and Apples of the world, you know, HBO is still the gold standard of television.
Okay, Pete, next up is Shadowplay. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so it's a show that's got a variety of broadcasters on board, but most interesting, it was created by Mans Marlind, who's the creator of The Bridge, or Bruin, as it was originally, which was a huge hit globally, which was remade in a number of territories. We've all seen different versions of it, whether it's the French and English version, or there was a Mexican version as well, and there's an Asian version this year. And he's teamed up with the director of I Know What You Did Last Summer, which, remember that old teenage high school murder mystery back in the 90s?
This is quite a mashup of talent, again. Drake exec producing. I Know What You Did Last Summer, and they're coming back with The Bridge.
Absolutely, and it's in English, which is interesting, because it's essentially been produced for a number of European broadcasters. Canal Plus in France. It's got Viaplay, which is a Scandinavian streaming service. NPO is a Dutch broadcaster. So there's a whole group, but it's interestingly being produced in English because they're obviously looking for an international market. It's got a big US exec producer. And one of the companies behind there is Bron, who, again, best known for the film world. You know, they've just made the Front Runner, which was the Gary Hart film that came out. And they also did Tully, which Charlize Theron was in last year. So they're again doing this sort of interesting crossover from TV to film. It's quite an interesting story. It's set in post-war Berlin. It's about an American cop who essentially goes over to Germany after the war to try and help them track down this Al Capone figure. He's got ulterior motives as to why he's coming over. He also wants to help find his brother, who has spent the last few months trying to find and kill ex-Nazis. And then it turns into this other mystery where he sort of inadvertently lands in the middle of the Cold War, or sort of starts this process which ultimately leads to the Cold War. So it's a really interesting project that, you know, takes lots of different bits from around the world and puts them together, which I think now that we're all watching shows on streaming services and, you know, in many different fashions, is probably the way forward.
And this is interesting. You mentioned all the kind of different production companies from different parts of the world that have a kind of finger in this pie. Is that a funding thing or is that a distribution thing? For some of our listeners that will be less familiar with this kind of world of how this stuff works, why are there so many kind of co-productions?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, I think it's because television costs more than it ever did, if you think back in the day. We used to talk about drama being made for about £1 million an hour. And now, you know, that's a paltry fee compared to some of the things. So largely money. But I also think the world's getting a bit smaller. 20 years ago, we didn't have access to foreign language television. You'd have had the big American shows, but you wouldn't have necessarily had anything from around the world. So I think the world's getting a bit smaller, which means that everyone else is getting their best of to come and represent. If you think about the creator of The Bridge, he's up there with any American auteur, really, in terms of you know, the things he's created. So, yeah, it's this interesting clash of cultures, really. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. You know, there was always a phrase where the television would become Euro pudding if it tried to merge too many cultures at once. But we seem to be doing a little bit better these days. So.
Beware the headline Euro pudding, voters. Peter White, thank you very much for gazing into your crystal ball on our behalves. That's TV in 2019. Cheers, Pete. Anna, we're boosting the size of that screen and we're going to the cinema. Where do you sit in a screening room as a critic and as a punter as well? Where's your favoured seat?
Well, I'm normally a critic rather than a punter because I see everything for work. But being not too tall, that's quite strategic. So I tend to sit fairly near the front, but also near the side of a row, just in case I have to pop out, because I don't like having to climb over people.
Okay.
But also, you've got to think about getting a really great view to get the best cinematic experience, obviously. So I would say it depends on the cinema and the screening room, because sometimes row three is better than row two. So it's a long answer, I'm afraid.
No, but it's a good one. I think people like to know things like this. I'm a kind of like middle left guy. Gareth?
On the end, towards the middle.
Okay. Pete?
Yeah, similar.
Yeah? What, similar to Gareth?
Similar to you.
Okay, I kind of like, I can't sit on the right. I don't know why I don't
yeah,
like
I'm
it.
Yeah, I'm more on the left. Yeah,
maybe it's because I'm slightly deaf and I need the sound to come into my right ear. I don't know what it is. Anyway, that's by the way. You're going to kick off with Yorgos Lanthimos's new movie, The Favourite.
Yeah, well,
lots of people will be excited.
Yes,
about this.
I absolutely love this film. It's already cleaned up at the BIFFA Film Awards. It's a tremendous period comedy drama with everything that you would expect that's weird about Yorgos Lanthimos added to it. It stars Olivia Colman as Queen Anne, and she basically is sort of sitting back and ruling by default in a kingdom which her courtiers are much more interested in running for her, and she's not particularly interested in politics. And Rachel Weisz plays her closest confidant in the court, and very, very close, as it turns out. And then Emma Stone comes in to her employ, and a rivalry ensues for Queen Anne's affections and her influence, really, in her favour.
Let's have a clip of this, then, to get us in the mood. This is The Favourite.
The Queen is an extraordinary person.
They were all staring, weren't they? I can tell, even if I can't see, and I heard the word fat, fat, and ugly.
No one but me would dare, and I did not. She's been stalked by tragedy.
Everyone leaves me. Dies.
Bit of Baroque, bit of bawdiness. I loved the trailer for this when I first saw this. Yorgos Lanthimos is, I guess his last film was The Lobster, which I found quite impenetrable, but I love Dogtooth. It's one of my favourite films for 20 years. I absolutely adore it. What bit of the Lanthimos universe are we in with this?
I'd say we're more like the first half of The Lobster. You know, if you're one of these people, the second half of The Lobster was a bit too rich for your blood, then the first half of The Lobster, which is a bit more sort of perky and funny and has a lot of Olivia Colman, then this is good for you. He also did The Killing of a Sacred Deer, which I found went a little too dark for me personally, but also had his trademark sense of humour and terrific performances. I'd say this is a lot more playful and light, and it certainly does something with period films that we have never seen before. It's certainly more physical than any I've ever seen, short of perhaps out-and-out comedies like Monty Python or Blackadder on TV, which is actually quite comparable. I think it has a similar sense of humour to Blackadder, actually.
Got a bit of a kind of Plunkett and MacLean vibe off this. Do you remember that film?
I do. It's better
Robert
than
Carlyle,
that.
Johnny Lee Miller.
Yeah. But absolutely.
It's nice to see people dressed in period, women in crinolines and men in kind of like what highwaymen outfits, doing ridiculous stuff rather than sitting around and doing soliloquies.
Exactly. Right. But what's great about this is that's only one element of many, many fantastic things about this film, because it also tells a true story and sticks, I think, broadly to a lot of the facts. There was obviously speculation about the level of people's relationships and, you know, were they having lesbian affair and such like. But it still has something to say about the politics of the time. It has something to say about ambition. It's kind of a portrait of celebrity life in a way, because Queen Anne, you know, in Olivia Colman's portrayal, is a woman who's incredibly bored, incredibly pampered, and can't trust anyone around her because she doesn't really know who she can trust, which is obviously a problem that a lot of famous people have and a lot of very rich people have. So it's actually very contemporary, and I'm not a fan of things that are anachronistic generally, and it's sort of put contemporary music in, but there are touches in this which are not correct, I'm sure, in terms of the dialogue and the way people speak and also some of the fabrics used for the costumes and such like. But I think that's done so well, and it's done so confidently, that it all just blends seamlessly in.
And there is something about the kind of suffocation of the kind of court and all this, as you said, you know, someone who's bored, pampered, hugely important, but can't trust anyone. How is that? Yeah, that kind of suffocating atmosphere. People have seen the trailer for this; they'll see the funny side of it. But how about the other pressure cooker points in it?
Well, that's an interesting question, because actually visually it's quite expansive and it draws back and it gives you a real sense of the scale of her court and the massive gardens. So it's a portrait of a woman in isolation in something which is the opposite of claustrophobic, or should be the opposite of claustrophobic. But the claustrophobia obviously comes from being alone most of the time and being lonely and not knowing who to trust. And what I loved about this film in many ways is that it's a portrait of female relationships and of women in kind of a man's world, even though she's the queen, because all the men, you know, in politics, they are men, women coming together to find friendship and companionship, but also displaying a lot of the same Machiavellian qualities the men around them do, if not more so.
Looking forward to this one, The Favourite. It's out January the 1st. Thank you very much, Anna. Can You Ever Forgive Me is next up.
Yeah, so this is Melissa McCarthy taking a rather more serious role than we're used to her seeing her in, but it is still a very comical performance. It's a film about a real-life writer who actually decided to forge the writing of wonderful writers of the past, like Noel Coward and such like. And she managed to get away with it a few times because she was such a great writer. And the comedy is that all these people are starting to pay for original writings, and handsomely, people who are supposedly experts, but they don't recognise that these are being forged by essentially a failed journalist. And Richard E. Grant plays her sort of gay best friend who's lounging around with no money in bars and just kind of jumping into her party. And he's absolutely brilliant, as you can imagine, as that. And this also comes from the director of Diary of a Teenage Girl, which I really liked.
Should we have a clip? This is Can You Ever Forgive Me?
Nobody is going to pay for the writer Lee Israel right now.
I'm months behind in my rent, and my cat is sick.
It's 4 in the afternoon, and you're drunk.
I'm hardly drunk.
Craig, top her up.
My suggestion to you is you go out there and you find another way to make a living.
That is Can You Ever Forgive Me? Melissa McCarthy and Rich D. Grant. This looks excellent. I mean, this is based on a true story, supposedly.
It is. The memoirs of Lee Israel, who managed to turn this whole episode into a winning book. So good for her.
There's a sort of triple weird layer of synthesis here. Being unsuccessful, forging letters, and then writing a book about the forging of the letters because you're unsuccessful, and then being successful at it.
Yeah, it's fantastically ironic in lots of ways. But you've got to take your hat off to her, haven't you? And the way she's portrayed by Melissa McCarthy is a very downbeat, rather abrupt woman who isn't particularly easy to like, but who has a wonderful turn of phrase and sense of humour and a sense of opportunity. And I think, again, that's a sort of role that we don't see very often in film, particularly played by a woman and particularly played by Melissa McCarthy. So I found all those elements refreshing, and also the buddy comedy element as well with Richard E. Grant.
And also going back to The Favourite, the Lanthimos that we were talking about earlier, Olivia Colman's been tipped for Oscar nods for that as well. It's a funny film. It's one of those things. What do you think her chances are?
For Olivia?
Yeah.
It's always a tough one, as you say, comedies and the Oscars. But I think if any comedy this year is in with a shout, it's The Favourite, because it's English, it's period, and it's got national treasures in it. And it's exceptionally good. So I think those things might help it, but it's got tough competition.
Okay. That was, though, Can You Ever Forgive Me?, from which you heard the clip starring Melissa McCarthy and Rich D. Grant. It's out on February the 1st. In quick form, Anna, you wanted to tick off The Jellyfish.
Jellyfish is a lovely British, again, comedy drama about a young girl who discovers a talent for stand-up comedy. She's played by Liv Hill, and that is definitely one to be recommended. That's out in February.
And Wild Rose.
Wild Rose is a very sweet story of a young girl who wants to be a country and western singer, and Julie Walters is in it, and Jessie Buckley is the star to watch.
I like Julie Walters and Julie Roberts getting mixed up.
Yeah, I don't know why I said that, but yeah.
Pretty Woman would be such a different film, wouldn't it?
Yeah, maybe they should do that.
So would Steel Magnolias, yeah.
Yeah. Anna, thank you very much for this year in film. That voice you heard recasting some of the movie greats was Gareth Harris. Hi, Gareth.
Hello.
What are you looking forward to in 2019, other than the normal jet-setting art newspaper life?
Aside from my jet-setting life, I'm looking forward to the exhibition Bill Viola Michelangelo, which is going to be at the Royal Academy, opening the 26th of January. It brings together 15 works by the old master, Michelangelo, mainly drawings on loan from the Royal Collection, and 12 moving image pieces by Bill Viola. The title of the show is Life, Death, Rebirth. So there are quite a few clues in there as to how the curator's going to approach both artists' work.
And so these are Michelangelo's pieces. These are sketches, am I right? These are works on paper?
Yeah, they're mainly works on paper, as I said, drawn from the Royal Collection. The co-curator is a guy called Martin Clayton. He's head of prints and drawings at the Royal Collection. And I think the idea for the show came about, I think, more than a decade ago when Viola visited London, and he visited the prints and drawings collection at Windsor Castle. And I think he went along to see the Leonardo drawings, but he was so taken by the Michelangelos that they both decided to mount a show. So that's how it came about.
And it's an interesting sort of work of curation, getting a very successful video artist and living artist to kind of communicate with someone of Michelangelo's stature. Are there any precedents for doing shows like this, mixing up ancient and modern?
Ooh, gosh,
I wonder.
Not many spring to mind. I mean, not compared.
No, I was trying to think, when I was looking at your notes, I was trying to think, what's like this? It's the sort of thing you might get at a biennale where it simply sits next to something, I suppose.
Yeah, I think it's quite interesting to bring an old master together with such a, well, I suppose, fairly radical video artist. And I think Bill Viola is up to the job, so to speak. You know, there's going to be a few key works by him. Something called The Messenger. It kind of shows a man slowly floating and sinking in water. That's going to be juxtaposed with Michelangelo's marble relief sculpture, which shows Madonna and Child. So I think there's going to be some very interesting pairings. There's another key work by Bill Viola called Tristan's Ascension, the sound of a mountain under a waterfall. But I think Martin Clayton, who is from the Royal Collection, he's He hopes to draw out the similarities in both artists' works. Basically, he wants to make perceptible the more spiritual aspects of existence through both Michelangelo and Bill Viola. So I think he's chosen, yeah, good people for this, basically.
Are these new works that Bill Viola's made for this show? I mean, has he kind of responded kind of quite precisely to these Michelangelo drawings?
I think the recent-ish works, actually. The Messenger dates from 1996. There are some works from the 90s. So as far as I'm aware, I don't think there are too many new pieces. I think it's more of a retrospective of Viola as seen through Michelangelo, but more or less, you know.
And Bill Viola is one of those interesting artists. People are always wondering where he's getting his inspiration from, I suppose. Or, you know what I mean? People find a lot of historical resonances in those works. Works that seem to be sometimes still on the surface, but kind of reveal themselves slowly. This seems like an exhibition to spend quite a lot of time at. This isn't a quick flick. No. Not that you would ever say anything was, Gareth, of course.
No, I mean, I definitely want to ponder. I think those very existential themes, such as the moments of transition at birth and death, transcendence through ecstasy, the fragility of life, I don't think you can rush through this one, really.
No, exactly. Everyone's going to be feeling great in January, right? I mean, some people will have had a sort of detox January, at least for 3 days or so. So people will be in the right frame of mind to communicate with these two great artists.
Totally. I mean, just the name Michelangelo, I mean, that's a kind of blue chip blockbuster feel to me. I think that will draw the crowds. It's a bit of a mistake to expect a huge exhibition of Michelangelo's works, but the drawings are exquisite, the Royal Collection pieces. I think it'll be a treat for both. If you're a fan of either artist, just pop along.
OK, let's move to Keith Haring. Is this his first huge retrospective, British retrospective?
Yeah, I think this is really interesting because, surprisingly, the Tate Liverpool show that opens on the 14th of June is the first, it's being billed as the first UK survey of the late graffiti artist's work. I was quite surprised by that. I think there have been very small shows previously, but nothing too substantial. But Haring is getting a little bit of a moment. I've just been at Art Basel, Miami Beach. There were loads of works by him on show with Levy Gorvy, who was showing a huge 1988 triangular painting called Silence Equals Death, which deals with the AIDS crisis. That was on sale at $8.5 million. So suddenly the market is catching up with him as well. I mean, the Tate Liverpool show will help, both commercially and critically. But yeah, I was surprised that this was the first big UK show. I think on the back of Basquiat, Jean-Michel Basquiat, we're looking for the next big street artist.
Yeah, it's an interesting, sort of. And he was, I remember interviewing the Rubels, who were the early collectors of him and were friends with him in New York in the kind of 80s and stuff. And he was kind of definitely an artist that was seemed to be formed by a consensus of collectors. Or can you give us a little background on Keith Haring?
Well, I suppose, I mean, the key thing, he was working on the New York subway. That was the thing. So the streets were his canvas, yeah, as such. I don't think it's been particularly easy to source key works. Perhaps that's why collectors are just catching up now. But the Liverpool show does mean they hope to reassess him as such. I think the curator, Darren P, said he's ubiquitous in the popular imagination, but we aim to show a more nuanced and complex side. And they've got some great things. They're going to be showing a black light installation 1982, which comprises a series of fluorescent works under UV light with a hip-hop accompaniment, this kind of thing. But I don't think they're going to shy away as well from the more racy subjects. I mean, he explored the AIDS epidemic of the 1980s, nuclear disarmament, the crack cocaine crisis that engulfed New York. So his Crack is Whack mural, which is on show at Harlem River Drive, that's going to be explored in the show. So I think they're going to look at the social and political commitment of Haring as a wider reassessment of the work.
As you said, Gareth, kind of collectors maybe are just catching up to Keith Haring, because I suppose, as with any street artist, lots of the stuff is not existing or it's been pulled off a wall or whatever. Do you think collectors and galleries have kind of finally found, after Banksy and obviously after Basquiat in a way, have found the way to market these things and sell them and actually show them in a museum space?
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, as you've just said, it's very difficult to replicate a street mural or graffiti on a subway. So I think now people are digging out their harrowing works from, you know, the basement as such, and they're going to take advantage of the market hype. I mean, it was noticeable in Miami that he's now in demand as such. So, but yeah, it's difficult, isn't it, with street art? How do you market it? How do you buy it? How do you, as a connoisseur, how do you approach it? I'm not sure, really.
Yeah, and what does it mean when it's not? When it's no longer in the place, but it was intended to be, I suppose.
Well, I mean, people are prepared to pay big bucks because the name is so popular at the moment. Tate Liverpool is just going to boost him in all sorts of ways, I think.
It's Keith Haring at Tate Liverpool. That's from the 14th of June to the 10th of November. We should also say that the Bill Viola and Michelangelo show at the Royal Academy is on from the 26th of Jan to the 31st of March. Just a couple of seconds to mention all the Rembrandts at the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam.
Yeah, I think I'll put my cards on the table and say Rembrandt is my favourite artist.
I was going to say, this seems like ever. This sounds like the best exhibition ever, this.
Yeah, it's the 350th anniversary of Rembrandt's death this year. So the Rijksmuseum, which I think has probably got the largest collection in the world, is going hell for leather on this. So the first big show that they're hosting in February, they're going to show all the works they own, which includes 22 paintings, 60 drawings, more than 300 prints as such. So they have the Night Watch as well. They have other key works such as the Jewish Bride. If you're obsessed with Rembrandt or with beautiful, brilliant art in general, just head along to Amsterdam, please.
And that is the loveliest museum in the world, isn't it? The
Rijksmuseum
is beautiful. Gareth, thank you very much indeed. That brings us to the end of this week's Monocle Culture Show. To recap, the things on our guests' radars are The Favourite and Can You Ever Forgive Me in cinema, Euphoria and Shadow Play on the TV, and Bill Viola Michelangelo at the Royal Academy, and Keith Haring at Tate Liverpool for your art fix. Thank you to all my guests, Peter White, Anna Smith and Gareth Harris, and of course to my producer Holly Fisher. We'll be back at the same time next week. For the time being, from me, Robert Bound, thanks for tuning in.